This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. Today, we bring you the first part of a two-part panel discussion on the topic of civility, or perhaps the lack thereof, in politics. This first part is titled The Challenge of Incivility, and it examines the polarization of the American electorate. And the panel members aim to address that polarization as a matter of understanding the challenges behind a functioning civil discourse. Speaking on the panel, retired Utah Supreme Court Justice Christine Durham, former state senator and CEO of the Women's Leadership Institute, Pat Jones, and retired KUTV Channel 2 reporter and journalist, Rod Decker. And moderating today's discussion is University of Utah's Political Science Department Chair, Mark Button. Here's Mark Button.
The organizers of this panel have given the title Civility in Politics, The Challenge of Incivility. I think that title comes from a fairly widespread observation, both by pundits and politicians alike, Supreme Court justices as well, that we are living right now in a time of a crisis of civility or a crisis of incivility. Now, of course, those kinds of statements assume a certain kind of baseline compared to what? Compared to what are our conditions uniquely defined by incivility? And more fundamentally, what do we mean when we talk about civility and incivility? So today, I'm hoping that we can all begin to work through some of those questions together, and I think we have a wonderful group of panelists to help us do precisely that. Since they've already been introduced, I will skip over that and just dive right into the substantive questions before us. And of course, we will welcome your comments and questions as well. So among the questions that I think we should be asking ourselves, both in this particular panel and one that will follow, I think next week, is what is civility? What does it really require of us, specifically? And who gets to define what civility is, and who gets to enforce the standards that it invokes? In a related way, I think we should also ask ourselves, is incivility always wrong or imprudent? Under what conditions might incivility, in fact, be an appropriate challenge to the operation and the conduct of politics, which is always under non-ideal circumstances? And related to that, does a free and tolerant society correctly tolerate incivility as a very condition or the price that's paid in giving freedom first standing within a society like our own? Of course, these are just a few of the questions that I think are prompted by the title of this panel and ones that I hope we'll all sort of think about as we listen to our panelists, starting with the Honorable Christine Durham.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here. What a fascinating topic has been selected for our discussion today. I come, of course, spent nearly all of my professional life in a forum, in a structure in which civility is essentially enforced. And it's guided, it's circumscribed by rule and by tradition and by expectation. Now, that doesn't mean that people in the context of dispute resolution within the courts in this country don't occasionally trespass on the boundaries of civility. But generally speaking, the courts require opposing parties and opposing counsel to treat each other with a certain amount of decorum and civility. You can say my learned opponent, you can say it with a snarl, but as long as you say my learned opponent, you're staying within the boundaries. Now, even our profession has been dogged by, I think, an increasing lack of compliance with the traditional expectations. And that's probably something that comes about by virtue of what's going on in our society. One of the questions John asked was, you know, how do we define civility? Who gets to define it? And what does it mean? My own views are that civility constitutes treatment of others that recognizes their basic dignity as human beings. Now, one of the things that I worry a great deal about in our current society and noting current trends is that we seem to have reached a point, and I noticed this was emphasized, there was a really excellent issue of the Atlantic magazine, I think a month ago or two, talking about, is our democracy safe? What's going on? And one of the observations in the editorial and one of the articles was that historically we have tended to deal, and often to deal firmly and loudly as Americans, with other Americans with whom we disagree. You go back to the founding, and they had some knockdown dragouts in terms of fighting for principles that they thought needed to be part of the new government going forward, and particularly things they thought needed to be embedded in the Constitution. Now, it's not that they didn't get pretty incivil on occasion. There were duels fought in the old days. It's important to remember, even on the floors of Congress. And there was plenty of high feeling and blood running hot in the founding debates. But what seems to have happened today is that we, as Americans, no longer simply view people who disagree with us as Americans who disagree with us. We seem to view them as the enemy. We seem to think that they are worse than some of our real enemies, external and foreign, for example. And we seem to bring that mindset into so much of our politics and so much of our discourse. And I don't frankly think that we are going to be able to make much headway in this crisis of incivility until we figure out ways in which to diminish that deep divide that makes us see each other as enemies. I understand it. I understand when some things happen in the political arena that I find absolutely abhorrent, and when I feel that institutions I revere are being undermined or attacked, I feel it. And I feel it, you know, sometimes with rage, sometimes with sorrow. What is it going to take to enable me and other American citizens to say, well, those people are wrong. They're fighting for something I oppose with every fiber of my being, but they are Americans too, and they love this country too. I think for a couple of centuries, we've managed to keep that fundamental love of country as a unifying principle amongst our citizenry, and I think we've lost it, or very close to losing it. I think we now see people who disagree with us not just as our enemies, but as not real patriots and not real Americans. And that divide, I think, is as toxic as anything we've ever seen in our history. I'll stop there. I'm sure others have really good ideas.
That was retired Utah Supreme Court Justice Christine Durham. And speaking next is retired KUTV Channel 2 reporter and journalist Rod Decker.
Thank you. Recently, a Texas judge threw out a lawsuit by former porn star Stormy Daniels. It was against the President of the United States, whom Ms. Daniels says was her former lover. The president tweeted in triumph, and he called Ms. Daniels horseface. Ms. Daniels tweeted back in defiance. She said, "Game on, Tiny." President Trump has, as one commentator said, presidentialized incivility. Journalist Megyn Kelly said to him, "You call women fat pigs." He said, "Only Rosie O'Donnell." Then he called Ms. Kelly later a bimbo. He is the most incivil president since Andrew Jackson, and maybe the most incivil president ever. It isn't just President Trump. Democrats have launched a restaurant offensive. Ms. Huckabee Sanders, took her family to a Red Hen restaurant in Virginia. She was recognized. They said, "We don't serve you. We know who you are. Get out." Stephen Miller, senior advisor to President Trump, ordered sushi. When he picked it up, the bartender said, "Hey, Steve," and gave him the finger with both hands. It made Mr. Miller so angry he threw away the sushi, and only afterwards did he think that it had cost him $80. Senator Ted Cruz was driven from a restaurant by fellow diners shouting, "We believe victims. We believe survivors. We believe survivors." Christian Nielsen, the Secretary of Homeland Security, was driven from a restaurant by some socialist students who shouted, "Shame, shame." Mitch McConnell and his wife were approached in a restaurant, and a man slammed his hand down on their table and started shouting at them. But this was in Kentucky, not in Washington, D.C., so other diners said, "Leave them alone, leave them alone," and they got to finish their meal. Now, incivility may be, we have more of it than we used to. But there's also a change, I think, and that is this. It bears on a question that Professor Button asked. Unusually, responsible people are speaking for civility. You always have some nuts on the internet and some crazies on both sides, but responsible people are speaking out. Last week, Hillary Clinton said in an interview, "Democrats must not be, won't be civil, can't be civil until we win at least the Senate or the House. Until then, no civility." Yesterday, in the Salt Lake Tribune, George Pyle, the editorial editor of the Salt Lake Tribune, compared civility to pacifism before World War II. He said there are times when it's okay to be against war, but this is a time civility, he said, may be just surrender. He said the fascists are in power in government, the fascist wing of the Republican Party. And while he said President Trump isn't like Hitler, it's closer than we would like to think that President Trump is close to Hitler. He defended at any rate, incivility. A nice, smart man. I wish to digress here a minute and talk about what civility is. It comes from the Latin word civitas, Latin for city. It means polite. Polite comes from the Greek word polis, which means city in Greek. Polite is also related to policy and politics. It's sort of the way they conducted politics a long time ago. Now, I want to make two observations. First, civility is never the most important thing. It's manners. Some things civility isn't. Civility isn't criminal stuff. If you shoot somebody, that's not incivil, that's criminal. They overlap. You might have a political fist fight. Hard to tell what it is. Depends on if it's a fair fight, I guess. Civility is not the higher virtues. It's not generosity or courage. It's manners, civility is. And civility is not policy. You can be for more immigrants or for no immigrants, and you can advocate either policy civilly or uncivilly. It is manners and therefore not the most important thing. I don't think the Republic will fall because Senator Ted Cruz is harassed in a restaurant. Mr. Pyle, while I don't agree with him, and I'll make my disagreement more specific in a minute, I don't think he's any threat. He's a nice fellow. There's a dwindling readership of the Tribune. Almost all of us are old. He might incite me to the streets were it not for my lumbago. So I don't know that it's terribly important or terribly worrisome. It's distressing. You don't like to see it. Now, the second thing I want to say is I disagree with what seems to be a premise of Secretary Clinton and Mr. Pyle, and that is, when you're serious, you get incivil. Now, as the etymology indicates, we've been civil or incivil, and we've been concerned about it 2,500 years. I think the reason is because civility works some of the time, maybe most of the time. I've been in Justice Durham's court, not I hasten to add as a defendant, I've been in Justice Durham's court, and you don't want to be incivil in Justice Durham's uncivil. She keeps order. In Congress or the legislature, they are civil because they hope maybe that their opponent now will be their friend later, and they want to maintain, keep good relations. It works. Does it work in elections? Well, maybe some of the time. You can't say that it works all the time, or we wouldn't have Mr. Trump for president. But it may work some of the time. If bad manners lead to effective politics, we are probably going to have more bad manners. The Annenberg School of Journalism did a study, and they found a pattern. Insults are treasured by the insulted in politics. It isn't Republicans who remind you that President Trump called some illegal immigrants rapists. Democrats bring that up. It isn't Democrats who bring up Hillary Clinton calling Trump supporters a basket of deplorables. Republicans bring that up. Insults can energize your opponents. Insults particularly can get them out to vote. The classic American example is the presidential election of 1884. Republican James G. Blaine was ahead. He went to a rally. One of his supporters, a guy named Burchett, said, "The Democrats are the party of rum, Romanism, and rebellion," referring to Prohibition, Catholics, and the Civil War. It infuriated Catholics. By the time the Republicans had figured they'd made a mistake, some of them tried to defend Burchett. They said, "He didn't say rum, Romanism, and rebellion. He said rum, Mormonism, and rebellion." That's what they said, but the Catholics didn't believe it, and Grover Cleveland won the election. Hillary Clinton and George Pyle seem to believe that uncivil politics is effective politics. When you get, we're civil because it pleases our moms and our Sunday school teachers, but when we get really serious, then we insult people. I hope that isn't true. It may have changed. But historically, 2,500 years maybe, good politics is civil politics. After the next election, whoever loses will think things over. If the Republicans lose, they're going to say, "Look, we've got a great economy. We're more or less at peace." Those are things that usually work for the governing party. What's our problem? Donald Trump's incivility is our problem. If the Democrats lose, at least the leaders, I think, will stop saying we should be incivil. They'll say maybe civility will work. They'll blame incivility for their loss. I think the Democrats will reform a little bit. I don't think President Trump is capable of reformation.
That's Rod Decker, retired KUTV Channel 2 reporter and journalist. Speaking next is former state senator and CEO of the Women's Leadership Institute, Pat Jones.
I hate to follow that. But they have set the table, both of the speakers so far have really set the table for something extremely important. And speaking of tables, how many of you are looking forward to your Thanksgiving dinner, talking politics over your Thanksgiving dinner with your family? Yeah, a couple of you are. I hear over and over how people are just dreading talking politics with their family. And I think, unfortunately, this is what incivility brings to the common person, is it makes us not feel comfortable in the settings that we want to feel comfortable in. Last week, I was following a car. You know, you're driving, you see a bumper sticker, and you really want to read it. So you get closer and closer. And this bumper sticker intrigued me because it said, "Putin 2020. Because with 300 million Americans, we just simply can't find a leader." And I just thought, where have we gotten? Where have we come because of so many things that are going on? In the year 2000, when people were asked, How is our system working? How is our U.S. system working? 68% of U.S. Citizens said we're doing well. And this year, it was 38%. So there's no question that there have been just some downturns in how we perceive how things are working in Washington and sometimes statewide as well. I want to just compare the differences and see where we've gone with the differences between effective leaders and effective politicians. Because in my mind, that is exactly what has happened. We seem to have had some effective leaders in the past, and I think we still do have some. Certainly we do, you know, here at home, and there are some nationally. But an effective politician is a person who does really well in getting reelected. So they go through all of those motions and get reelected. An effective leader, on the other hand, is a leader that rebuilds public confidence and restores and elevates rather than demeans. And I think that's where people are coming from today. I certainly hear it in my work with the Women's Leadership Institute. We have our political development series, which this is our fourth year. We have a record number of women who are planning to run for office. And so it's not just nationally you're seeing that. You're seeing that here at home as well. And so I think that's a great solution. But I wanted to just take a few minutes that I had to talk about poor winners. We talk about poor losers from time to time. When people, you know, just seem to not get a break and so forth. But I think in our system now, we have a lot of poor winners. I'm going to give you a couple of examples like that. Because when people feel marginalized, they don't want someone to stick their nose in it. Okay? They don't want to be rubbed down even further. I think winners can and should maybe give some small wins to those that don't often give wins, okay? I'm going to give you three examples. Number one, when I was in the state Senate, we usually took a tour somewhere in the state, and you know, we would go visit places, and it helped you understand what was going on in those certain counties. This one year, we were touring Salt Lake County, and we were given very careful instructions to leave your concealed weapons guns at home. Don't bring them with you, because we were going to the refinery where they didn't allow concealed weapons. So there were several emails that were sent out saying, leave your concealed weapons at home. So we got on the bus, you know, we drove up to this place, and all of a sudden our bus stops suddenly, and several of the legislators climb off the bus. And we look back there, and there's a van that they had rented where they checked their weapons. And I have to say, I was appalled. You know, we were carefully instructed not that I would bring them anyway. I don't have one, but it really made me, I was just really ticked at that. And so after we went on the tour, one of the senators that had gotten off the bus, I walked over to him. And I said, help me understand why it's so important to you that you have a concealed weapon on you all the time. And he told me that he, when he was on the city council, had been threatened. His life had been threatened. And it helped me understand him, even though I didn't agree with him. But it helped me understand why he felt the way he did. And I think that's so important when we're talking about civility, there's always a reason why people behave the way they do. And it's helpful for us to understand, what is that reason this person is behaving that way? I want to just jump to the next example. When I was watching the Kavanaugh hearings, which I'm sure many of you watched as well, when Dr. Ford was giving her testimony, And she talked about, what was the thing you remember most? Remember that question? What was the thing that stuck with you? What bothered you? What do you have a hard time forgetting? Do you remember? Yeah, it was the laughing, wasn't it? You know, so it wasn't enough to be a victim. It wasn't enough. It was the fact that these two young men were thumbing a nose to her. We're making it worse. She was marginalized. She was a victim. And I think that kind of behavior is really what's spawning a lot of this negativity and the incivility in our country. I'll give you one more. Last week, I just happened to watch the McAdams Love debate. Did any of you watch that? Okay. I found that really interesting. When Mia Love said to Ben McAdams that a remark that he didn't live in the district, all of a sudden, this flood of memory came over me because I was in the Senate at the time that they redistricted. And there were several different plans that would have worked really quite well. And I thought, you know, Salt Lake County, although it is by far the most populated county, there is not one of our congressional representatives that lives in Salt Lake County, not one. And for her to say, you don't live in our county, well, it's because her party had redistricted so many people out of it and carved our county up. I remember when we were going through that, I live in Holiday. They were planning to divide Holiday up into three congressional districts at the time. And I called our mayor and said, you better get up here because Holiday is going to be three different congressional districts. You're going to have to work with three congressional people if you're dealing with roads and so forth. And so he did. Well, how kind of them to keep us intact. However, as I sit in Salt Lake County and Holiday, I now share a congressman with the Navajo Nation in San Juan County. You know, so I couldn't help but feel marginalized again by her comment that here he lives just outside the district. Well, yes. And so these kinds of comments, if you're a winner, if you tend to be on the winning side, if you will, I think it's imperative that we can not rub it in people's faces in it. You know, that we can give some people a win. And I just see that over and over. So I think to seek to understand other people and understand where they're coming from, I think would help civility. The other thing that really helps civility, and we know this from a lot of research, is diversity. Is to have many different people involved, whether it's gender diversity or cultural diversity or socioeconomic diversity. Diversity really helps civility when people get to know and understand each other. And that is something, again, I work with every day in my work with women. And then finally, I don't think we can underscore the importance of encouraging debate, I mean true debate. When you look at the skills that so many of our employers are looking for but having difficulty finding, they are oral communication, written communication, and critical thinking and problem solving. Those kinds of things that help you look at other sides of things are so important that those skills are learned. And I think if we could encourage debate in our homes, in a way that we can help, you know, each other look at other sides of things in our workplaces and so forth, I think we need to encourage our public education system and higher education system to focus on the importance of debate. And then finally, I call it eating your own cooking. And that is, we really need to set an example. And if you're going to cook something, you're going to have to eat your own cooking. That we have to by just our example. And for all of you, run for political office if you really want to make the system better. I would strongly urge you to run for political office. I served 14 years in the state house and Senate. It was the best experience I've had. It was the best training I've ever had on just how to be a leader. So I would strongly encourage that.
Could I just, I'd really like to respond to a couple of themes that emerged from my colleagues. And one of which, I spoke about divisions and the degree to which our country has been sorting itself into camps for a lot of years with big disconnects between the camps. But one of the reasons for that, there are several, but one of them has been highlighted by the former senator, and that is the ability of incumbent politicians to get reelected. And they care, in many cases, more about getting reelected than any other policy choices they make. And that you've heard, you all heard, you've done Poli-Sci 101, you know what gerrymandering is. You've just heard a very vivid description of what gerrymandering can do to communities of interest and to create divisions between them. The other thing that Rod pointed out was the impact of the media. The 24/7 news cycle and the rise of social media have enabled people to send the worst of themselves instantaneously across the board, although my husband told me he just saw a study that said that actually a relatively small proportion of the population listens to Fox News, and an equally small proportion of the population listens to MSNBC and CNN, which surprised me a little bit. I don't know. I don't recall who did the study and wonder if it's any good. But those two media outlets are a really good example of the way in which we sort ourselves out. And I'm guilty. To be honest, my blood pressure won't stand watching Fox News for longer than about, you know, I was going to say 5 minutes, but it's closer to three. And I'm probably pretty typical in that regard. We self-sort, and the media and our communication system and the ability of politicians to choose their voters and design their districts so they can stay in office are huge contributors to that problem.
And you were listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. On this program, as you might already know, we record and broadcast some engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them unedited, mostly in their entirety, as a public service. And today we are airing a panel discussion from a few weeks ago that focuses on the challenges of incivility within today's politics. Here again is today's moderator, Mark Button.
Okay, well, now is the time for all of you to participate in this discussion. So we want to hear from you. We want to hear your questions and your thoughts. Please speak into the microphone. Please do so clearly and concisely. John, the point about concisely is for you.
So my question is a hypothetical for the three of you. In most off-year elections, most off-year presidential elections, turnout is quite low. And indeed, turnout in our state has been dropping for a number of years. But let us imagine that come the November election, we see a 15% increase in the number of people voting. Regardless of who wins, we just see that it's really captured the attention of the American public. Does that mean that incivility may have rejuvenated our democracy?
Incivility comes because people are angry. It makes people angry. Angry people are likely to vote. Yes, if the turnout is high, I would expect maybe a higher than a normal turnout. And I would think it's partly due to incivility. It's an ill wind.
Well, we've heard of POWs. I'm seeing pissed off women. I hate to say it that way, but it's very true. We're seeing a lot of women that are, I wouldn't even call it that. I wouldn't say some of them are angry, but I think it's more of a women's renaissance. I think women are seeing their, and I think women will make a difference in this election. I think women will be the key to this election. But I do feel that they are seeing the responsibility that we have to step up and have more civility in our elections and more responsibility. And I think young people too. Young people will definitely make a difference. So maybe it did cause a lot of this interest. If it did, maybe it was worth it. I mean, I always look at one thing that has come out good from the last presidential campaign is maybe we know what we don't want.
Yeah, I'm not so sure that you can tag incivility with the causation element of a higher vote count. I think you can tag anger, disappointment, concern about what we're getting in our elected officials. That's pushing people. People are energized and mad. But it may be as much for the policy decisions that are being made and imposed on people and the sense of being marginalized in terms of the results of past political elections that's driving people. So I'm not so sure, although I do think Rod has a point that people being mean to each other does tend to get people excited. But I think it's deeper than that. I think it goes to, well, probably the term marginalization is one of the most important ones that's been mentioned here. People who, and women are a good example of that, who have a sense of not having had a voice in what's going on in their country and feeling that something needs to be done about that.
Two quick things. First of all, sore winners. The best example I know of is bear's ears. For Native Americans, it was a question of religious freedom. For Utah's leadership, it was a question of hating the United States government. A former president who was black, and Indians in general, who are really marginalized in this state. Second, many Native Americans have white representatives. What is wrong with having a representative from the Navajo Nation?
I have to say that that's a really amazing example. All I know is what I've read in the press, but I recall seeing some of the comments and debates of the white population in that part of our state, and the sense of entitlement that inhabited those comments and those statements. We're the people who settled this place. And I'm thinking, no, you aren't. you weren't here first. And this notion that other people who are different from you are somehow not entitled to a voice in the governance of the area was just very distressing to me.
Well, and I wanted to say, I hope you didn't take that as pejorative. My point was, is that I don't know how much we would share in common in Salt Lake County with, you know, having representative. But I would love to have someone from the Navajo Nation represent me. I would love to have that person have an opportunity to win. That's what I'd love to see, is that they had a sizable chance to win, because we need more competitive races in our state, not less competitive. And this is one of the reasons why we see so many people not voting in Utah. We have one of the lowest turnouts in the nation, and it's because we don't have competitive races.
Certainly a Navajo would improve the state legislature, an acknowledged. Several might improve the state legislature. My understanding of San Juan County may be incorrect, but my understanding is this. A majority of the residents are Native Americans. However, they don't turn out to vote for various reasons. Therefore, a majority of the votes cast in every election for the past, perhaps forever, have been white votes. So the judge rearranged the ballots so that though there will be fewer Native American votes, more Native Americans but fewer votes, there will be more Native Americans on the in the outcome, or so he hopes, and so it may well be. I don't know whether you say because there are more Native Americans, therefore they should rule, or whether you say because there are more voters, they should rule. It seems to me to be a serious question. I believe that it has not been fairly reported here. I believe that it's often reported as we've got a bunch of white racists down there who are keeping down the majority. And while you can say that, I think there's another side.
And you are listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. This is a Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. If you're just joining us, today we are airing the first part of a two-part panel discussion titled Civility in Politics, The Challenge of Incivility. In this final segment, the panel takes further questions from the audience of faculty and students.
Hi. Regarding what you said earlier about how there's a divide in this country between people becoming, you know, there are patriots and then there are people who are becoming less patriotic, you know. So regarding the upcoming midterm elections and civility, if Republicans keep Congress in the 2018 midterm elections, What do you think that'll do for civility from these people who, I'm sure you've heard the term, Trump derangement syndrome, and just people who are just so angry at the state of this country, hate this country, they're just not patriotic. You know what I mean? What do you think that if Republicans do keep Congress in this upcoming election, what could that do for the state of this country, meaning non-patriots versus patriots? I mean, could there be a full-blown civil war?
That's the worst kind of incivility, I'll tell you. Well, it's interesting. It depends a little bit on what Pat Jones was talking about, and that's the response of the winners. I mean, one of the things that I found, so many things, but so disheartening about Trump's presidency and the Trump administration is that he doesn't even conduct a pretense of representing the country, all of the country. He focuses on his base. He focuses on people who agree with him. And he literally demonstrates day after day that he doesn't give a damn about what the rest of us think about the future of the nation. Now, that's not a good winner. And a winner and winners have the opportunity to knit the frayed fabric and put it back together. And I suppose if the midterms go in favor of the status quo in terms of the Republican Party, there will be a giant opportunity for them to do that. I wish I could be more sanguine about their willingness and ability to do that, but that would be a good outcome in my view. People worry about the move that's going on in terms of the increases in the powers of the presidency, of the executive branch, the passivity of Congress in the context of that increase in executive power, and the degree to which the federal courts, at least, are being completely reshaped by that very same set of institutions. And given all those circumstances, I think we are in peril. I don't know that civil war is the issue, but I think we are. In fact, I don't think that we see that. But I do believe that we are in peril of losing some really important essentials in the way our nation operates.
I think we have an incivil war right now.
Yeah.
frankly. And I think what's it's causing, it's almost like, how many of you have you ever made a cake? Ever made a cake? Okay, so have you ever done it not well, like I usually do, and it sinks in the middle, okay? I think we ought to think of that, because I think we have like the bell curve where you have that 66% in the middle that are becoming apathetic and not standing up, and they're voting for the most part. But they're just not engaged. And, we used to be a country where there were people that couldn't read, and now there are people that don't read. And I think we need to read up. I've had a lot of people ask me, even just recently, how do I really find out who these people are? I can't believe everything I see on television and everything. Well,
Facebook.
Yeah, exactly. And so, we need to do a better job, I think. There's some people trying to do this, and I think the Hinckley Institute certainly does this, but to help people understand who these people really are. But you have to make an intentional decision to go out and ask questions.
To the question, if the Republicans win, Trump will be insufferable. If the Republicans lose, Trump will be insufferable. If the Democrats win, they will try to impeach President Trump. That will lead to more argument. I don't think anybody's going to shoot. I don't think we are in nearly as much trouble as everybody else seems to think we're in. I think that this is an unpleasant time, and I disapprove of the incivility. But this is America. People are still trying to get in, not trying to get out. Have another beer.
You like beer?
How'd you guess? Yeah.
Are you done, Rod? Okay. So I had a big, long wind-up question, but it's too long. But it does have to do with marginalized groups coming forward. And how do you draw the line then in a movement like Me Too or Black Lives Matter, which many people in privileged positions have dismissed as, you know, just a bunch of angry people, and, you know, they're wrong, they're angry, but seem to be very effective. I think for sure, just in recent memory, the Me Too movement has been largely effective in bringing down some powerful figures who needed to be called out a long time ago. How can you differentiate? And by the way, your opinions have been wonderful. But how do you differentiate something like that to just plain old boorish incivility?
You know, we've always had groups that agitate, and I mean that in a positive way. And they're the ones that usually kind of think up new ideas, and then they agitate. They get people thinking about things. Maybe we ought to look at this decision. So I kind of see them as the baseline, for really important baseline that can get policymakers to start thinking about solutions. So it just slowly, you know, builds up pressure on them. So it's, you know, I think it's, they're important. I think those activists, if you will, are really important to our process.
I agree with that. The Me Too movement is really interesting because, and one can only applaud a public discourse which allows people who've been marginalized and silenced for long periods of time to have a voice, to tell their stories. And we've seen incidences in which very powerful people have been brought down by the stories they've told. But there's part of me that's very wary about the long-term impact of this movement, although I agree with Pat about needing activists and needing people to move us forward in our thinking. But that particular problem, the degree to which women have been marginalized in domestic and private life, in employment and public life, that goes back so far. I mean, we're talking thousands of years that goes back. And I'm waiting to see what actual policies, changes in the law, ability to enforce can actually emerge from this process. I worry about it because, you know, it's good to bring down powerful people who've exercised that in such an abusive and terrible way, but these kinds of things go on in every diner, every restaurant, every little insurance office, probably in plenty of law firms. I mean, these are endemic practices in which women are diminished, denied opportunities, and abused, harassed, and sometimes assaulted. And that is really endemic in our society. And I heard a terrible item on NPR today talking about the impact of VAWA, the Violence Against Women's Act, and it's hard to evaluate, but the incidences of domestic violence in an era when crime has been going down, domestic assault has held steady. And that's in the period since VAWA was passed. So I'm worried about how effective we're going to be in dealing with this particular problem.
I didn't see the NPR report or hear it. The report I saw was a really large decline in domestic violence since about 1980. And I think the report I saw, it was several years ago. And probably that was because before 1980, before 1980, they said, "Well, so are you going to divorce him?" Since then, the authorities take it seriously, and that was what the authors of the report, they thought that's why it had gone down. So it may have gone back up, or the report. All of this, domestic violence is hard to measure. You don't know. I tried. I made a good faith effort to try and find out how many domestic violence related murders there had been in Utah over past few years, and there were diverse statistics, and it's hard to know. About civility, my thesis is if incivility works, we will have incivility. If bad manners work, people will have bad manners. Maybe some of our
of our incivility in general is due to successful incivility on the part of Me Too. They don't seem to me to be especially incivil. I guess they are some, but I wouldn't single them out as the least mannerly crowd. But Black Lives Matter, Me Too have broken some of the mannerly norms, and they've had some success. And if bad manners works, people will use bad manners. If it doesn't, they won't. Now, almost everyone here would agree that on each of those issues, and on almost any issue, manners aren't the most important thing. Manners are much less important than other things, and you focus on the other things and let manners sort themselves out as they may.
So was it good manners when someone finally stood up and said to Joe McCarthy, "Have you no shame? At long last, sir, have you no decency?" That's interesting. I think that was civil, but it was powerful.
Back when I was a young politician and Rod was a reporter, he was quite a bit older, of course. Oh, I didn't mean to be uncivil. I was afraid to say anything negative. That was 1976. There was a different take on it then. The other night when I watched McAdams and Love, I was very disappointed that it was just this back and forth, back and forth. They got to the question of air quality, which I have a lot of heart in and care about, and a lot of us do. Neither of them answered it at all. They used their time block to blunt or to attack other attacks. And so to the degree that incivility kills discussion of the issues, that's where we really suffer.
I think this is a really good point. I know we're not supposed to ask the questions, but I'm kind of curious, looking at all the young people in the room and the students, whether any of what we from our generation, of course Pat's much younger, but Rod and I go back a long time, does this make sense? Does this resonate with the world you see and experience?
Yeah, I'm kind of in a unique position to answer that, I think. Half my family are really Democratic and the other half are very Republican. And I remember the last 20 years seeing them become increasingly polarized, and you'd have discussions that would quickly get to arguments, to quickly get to name calling. And the only time I could see there being headway was in when I was able to stop the debates. We don't want to debate. We all know you have opinions. All debates are showcasing your opinions and showing how logically they work. But that's not the point of these discussions. The point should be discussion, where I care about this, you care about this. How do we reconcile this? Rather than, oh, I'm better than you. So I don't know, could you talk about how do we promote more discussion versus debate in our political talks?
Someone mentioned earlier, I think, John, there are a lot of really impressive people who are trying to focus on that problem. Actually, Salt Lake City has been selected as a host city for something called a Bridge Summit, which should happen in a year or two. And a number of public leaders have been gathered and people from the community. But it's intended to be a national conference. And it's interesting, the backstory as to why they picked Salt Lake City was quite interesting to host this conference. But their plan is to get really high-profile people from politics, from the clergy, from significant groups, marginalized in other words, otherwise, and bring them together under some developed strategies and structures that will promote exactly that kind of exchange, actually trying to understand why other people are the way they are, and then look for ways to find compromise and come together. Whether that's pie in the sky, I don't know, but I think it's an effort that's going on a lot of fora around the country.
I wanted to address Mr. Wilson's question. Incivility may drive out substantive discussion. Yeah, maybe so. I don't
know that substantive discussion is that important. People who want to find out can read the newspaper, and
they're going to find really substantive discussion in the media.
I didn't watch Love McAdams. I'm retired, and I've decided I only watch that stuff when I'm paid. So I didn't see it, but I think both of them have sort of lost control of themselves. I think there's an opportunity for to fake statesmanship. Even if you're mad, I think you're one of them who could fake statesmanship or stateswomanship might do a little better.
Hi, thank you for your comments. This has been really wonderful. I have a question that's closely related to civility, and that's respecting institutional norms. And the thing that I'm thinking about in particular is the fact that there's an argument to be made that there has been a stolen Supreme Court seat, that Mitch McConnell broke norms in holding that seat open for 10, 11 months. And now the debates are happening amongst my friends and I about, well, what if Democrats end up getting the Senate for 6 years. Is it right in that case to hold, and we have another chance to get that Supreme Court seat back? Do we then hold that seat for 4, 5, 6 years? And I think there's arguments to be made. On one hand, you know, what I would tell my children is no, two wrongs don't make a right, that norms need to be kept. On the other hand, there's the angry part of me that says, no, that seat was stolen, we deserve it back, or even the utility argument that bad things will happen if we give one more Supreme Court seat. So I'm curious about your thoughts on respecting institutional norms, how that ties with civility, and maybe even your specific thoughts about this question.
That's a great example. It doesn't so much boil down on the civility side, because you can be very polite about refusing to give someone a hearing for a year. I think Mitch McConnell pulled that off very well. But it was a dastardly act, and it did flout all the norms, and it also flouted the authority of a sitting president. I mean, it was, so on the other hand, it worked, and they got the seat, and they got the judge they wanted in the seat they wanted, which gave them a huge leg up on their long-term agenda vis-a-vis the United States Supreme Court. So part of me thinks, well, the strategy worked extremely well, even though it wasn't within the normal course of doing business. And what's the argument? You nailed it. There's a utility argument, and then there's a moral argument. And it depends on what you, but I'm not sure it's a civility argument. Although it does connect to the divide that I've been talking about. So, I mean, I guess I'd like to see the Democrats try it, but I could be wrong about that.
Specifically, people say we ought to honor institutional norms. Sometimes that's true. Almost everybody here would say we ought to have change. Sometimes that is true. There are institutional norms with respect to, say, race and sex. The people would say no, those institutional norms ought to be overturned, at least in the past. So I don't know that institutional, saying something is an institutional norm simply means to say that that's what we've done in the past. Whether you like what we've done in the past is a different question. There's no question in my mind that if the Democrats get a chance to not have a hearing on a Trump nominee, that they'll take it. They may say, this is not the best thing, but we have no choice. They leave us no choice. Republicans, you'll remember, when they did it, they pointed to the Democrats throwing out the filibuster with respect to judges. They said the institutional norms have already been violated. They violated them. They got their norm. We'll take our norm. Surely it's going to be hard on the court. I think we can survive that. I think we'll have trouble if somebody comes on board and there isn't an opening and they say, FDR had the right idea. Let's have another. The country's changed. We've grown larger. We need more justices. And I think that there's a possibility that will happen. And while I while I am either dull and stupid or sanguine, I don't worry very much about what's going on now. I would worry a little bit about that.
That's Rod Decker, retired reporter and journalist for KUTV Channel 2 News. If you'd like to hear the full discussion, you can find it on our website, kcpw.org. Today's forum was recorded a few weeks ago on October 22nd, 2018. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund, and I'm Christian Camargo, your producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening.